The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers followed by our information break. Then our main speaker, who shall speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Nick.
Hi, my name is Nick, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 20th, 2013. I have a sponsor. His name is Rocco. I'm currently sponsoring someone, and I'm working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to jump right into it and spend 5 minutes telling y'all a little bit about what it was like, and I'm going to spend about 5 minutes telling you about how different my life is now. I grew up in a tiny town of 500 people in Ontario, Canada. And, you know, we lived on a farm, but it wasn't an operating farm. My father cut down trees for a living. And we lived a very, very modest life. And, you know, my father was able to put a roof over our heads, and we all had our responsibilities just trying to make it work. You know, my father was an alcoholic, and he died in 2010, never having the benefit of this program. So all of my life, I saw a very angry man with an extremely, extremely bad temper. And he was not only verbally abusive, he was physically abusive to everyone in my family, my mom, my brother, my sister, everyone but myself. You know, looking back, if I could change it, and if I could have it different, I would have put myself before him. But at the time, I didn't have the courage. And so inside those walls, I was just completely riddled with fear, anxiety, and discontent. And outside those walls, growing up as a young man, you know, I was still extremely scared on the inside. But on the outside, I had a different persona, and I felt like I had to live up to my father's tough guy persona. If you were bigger than me, I saw my father in you, and I was scared of you, and I would back down from you. If you were smaller than me, I used that as my means to show that I wasn't scared. So I was your quintessential bully. And if any of us know a bully in here, they know that we're a lot more scared than anyone. When I was 13, I had my first experience with alcohol. I had two beers in the back of Joe Lester's brother's Woody Wagon, and we proceeded that night to go to a high school dance. I was in grade 9, and I remember, you know, instantaneously after that first sip of beer, I'm sure it wasn't my first sip, but it felt like it, just feeling relief. And all of that fear and all that anxiety at that moment was just gone. And it allowed me to be funny. It allowed me to have confidence. I was good looking. It allowed me to talk to the girl. It allowed me to talk to the guy. It just allowed me to be a person that I just wasn't comfortable being when I was sober. And from that moment, alcohol became my number one priority in life. Fast forward to when I was 18 years old, you know, I, like every other Canadian, my aspiration was to play in the National Hockey League. And in 1998, I had the opportunity to go to a National Hockey League training camp. And you would think that the summer leading up to that camp, you would train day in, day out, you would give 110%, and you would put yourself in a position to be successful at that camp, but I couldn't do that because my workouts throughout the week were, you know, two steps forward and one step back, because Thursday through Sunday, I would just go out and get hammered. That's the only thing I wanted to do, was feel that way, because I didn't like my life when I was sober. And so as you can imagine, I didn't have a great camp, and after 4 years of major junior hockey in Canada, I had to give up my hopes of ever playing in the National Hockey League, and I decided that I had to go to school. So I went to college in Canada, and now for the first time in my life, there were no rules. There was no one telling me what to do, what to eat, how to work out. You know, I was on my own. I lived off campus. I played hockey. So for 3 nights a week, I could get hammered, but in the other nights, I had to practice and play games. And then once the season would end in February, I could then go out 7 nights a week, round the clock. And I remember that first year when I had the ability to do that, I was just like, this is the greatest thing. This is the greatest thing ever. I did okay in school. I graduated, just fine. And I think a lot of us in here or I'll just speak for myself, I could manipulate you and everything to my benefit. And I managed to do that and land a pretty decent job here in the city. And this was in 2004. Within a year, a little bit of money in my pocket, I had the means to go out and enjoy the city like any alcoholic would. Drugs are part of my story. I'm not going to get into that tonight. I'm going to stick with alcohol. I'll say in 2010, I remember it was my, I think, fifth year on Wall Street, and it was a year where I earned the most that I had earned to that date. And I was in a meeting with my boss, and he paid me that year, and 90% of my compensation was in the form of a bonus. And I remember just having this feeling of joy, because I honestly couldn't believe that I was making that much. I grew up, my father maybe made $25,000 a year. I was appalled. And I went and I sat down at my desk, and I got a text from my brother and saying that, you know, Dad's been in an accident. And he had fallen out of a tree, which again was his job. He was an arborist. And he, by the time I could get home to contact my brother to see how he was, he had passed away. And my alcoholism really took a turn for the worst, and also my drug usage. And look, I'll just fast forward to where I was 6 months ago. Towards the end of my alcoholic career, it just had become really dark. And I really started to isolate. I was spinning so many lies, both in my personal life and in business, that I couldn't differentiate between the truth and what were lies at that point. And I had been in trouble with the police leading up to that. I had had health issues. For me, I had just met who is now my fiance, the greatest person that I ever met in my life, and the one person who had accepted me for all my character defaults. And I just time and time again continued to let her down. And so I was in a bad place. And I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous about a year ago. And for the first 6 months, I relapsed probably every month or two. I think I strung together about 2 months because I just wasn't willing. And like everything else in my life, I just figured that I could do it my own way. You know, here I was. I mean, the book talks about big shotism. I had big shotism. I had a God-sized ego, but I had a huge God-sized hole in my heart. And I just felt like I could do it on my own. And even this last go-around, 5 months ago, I was a month in, and I still was doing it my own way. And when I met my sponsor, we talked. He actually called me after I met him. I stumbled upon the Big Book meeting by accident. And days later, when I called him back, I said, Rocco, I'm on my fourth step. Do I need a sponsor for that? And he didn't laugh at that point. He just said, yeah, we recommend that everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous has a sponsor to go through the steps. I literally just did the steps like one, sure, two, done, three, okay, four, that looks a little difficult. Maybe I should get some help with that. But it's just a testament of my alcoholism. And look, it was extremely difficult for me to take direction from someone else. I felt like I had gotten here solely on my own, and the thought of listening to someone else and just taking simple direction was very difficult for me. But we started very simple, and we wrote slogans on the inside of my big book. Keep it simple, first things first, one day at a time. And I needed to pound that home, and Rocco has certainly helped me accomplish that. And when I say keep it simple, it's, start to come to a meeting every day. I did my 90 and 90. I woke up in the morning, I made my bed. Okay, now I have a series of prayers that I say, but I try and get with God. Throughout the course of the day, I call three alcoholics. All right, I get to my meeting. If I'm not 15 minutes early, I'm late. I try and reach out my hand and introduce myself to a day counter. I just keep it really, really simple. And, it's not easy. And when I first came in here, I would listen to people in my position, and I would say, you're crazy. And there's no way. I looked at the steps, and I thought, it's just impossible. But I'm living proof that it's possible, and it's really just one day at a time. Now I have the opportunity to work with other guys. I'm working with one guy now, and it's a beautiful experience. Like I said, I'm working through the steps, and I've had the opportunity to make 35 amends, so go back in my past and apologize to people who I've harmed, which has just been an unbelievably beautiful and uplifting and another massive relief. And look, it's not easy. I'm not perfect. I struggle with this you know, on a maybe a daily basis, certainly a weekly basis, but I have a sponsor to rely on. My life is dramatically better, and I owe a lot of it to you. And if there's one piece of advice I could give, and the one thing my sponsor said is don't do that to people, but don't make the mistake that I did. Get a sponsor, start working the steps, get into action, your life will be better. Thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Devin.
Hi, I'm Devin. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me here. Thanks, Hannah, for asking me to speak. I'm really nervous, but this is really cool, and I did my service commitment tonight. Speaking to the mic already, okay. And I did a service commitment last night, and I worked with a sponsee, and, you know, it's not about me, so that's cool. I want to thank my mom, because she's here, and she took me to my first meeting, so... that's cool. And, I talked to my sponsor before this, and I, like, really wanted her to feel bad for me because I was so nervous, and I was like, you know, I just can't believe that I have to do this. And she was like, okay, like, you are being really self-centered, and you're not that important. Like, talk to newcomers. And, like, that's what it is. You know, like, that's what it always is, because I always think that, like, my problem is different. And in reality... You know, like, every fear I have about, like, standing up here is about myself because I have a huge ego, and I want to sound good, and I want to look good. But, like, you know, it's just, I came here and I didn't know, like, how to live my life at all, and, like, someone showed me how to do that. And I also, like, I wanted to say, because I had a lot of, like, conspiracy theories when I came here, and, like, I'm not up here because, like, I'm the chosen one who's, like, some type of alcoholic that it works for, and, like, so, like, it's not any of that. Like, I did what is in the book and, like, what my sponsor told me to do, and it worked, which was, like, crazy to me because I didn't think it would. You know, I thought I was different. I thought, you know, AA was a punishment, I guess, because I had to do, like, a lot of, like, alcohol education at the school I went to, like, by force, because I kept getting in trouble, and I thought that's what this was. Like, I thought it was, like, just don't drink, like, you have messed up really badly, you know, and it wasn't that. I really don't know what I'm saying right now, but okay. but, yeah, I mean, I don't really have, like, a special story. I didn't drink for a long time. Like, I thought that made me different. I thought because I was young that made me different. I thought, like, anything, you know, but I had an abnormal reaction every time I drank, like, and I couldn't explain it. Like, my friends would be like, I don't understand, like, just drink the same amount as us, like, just drink less. And I was like, you're right, like, exactly. And then I would wake up in the hospital again, you know. And that's how it always was. I mean, the last time I drank was not that different from many other times. It wasn't the first time I woke up in the hospital. It wasn't the first time I started drinking in the morning and went all day. But for some reason, you know, even though it wasn't really... I only asked for help because I wanted people to feel bad for me, and I knew I was going to get kicked out of school, basically. But that's what I needed. And I also just remember, like, waking up in the hospital again, and I wasn't surprised at all, and that kind of actually struck me as abnormal. Like, I was like, oh, here I am again, like, it didn't work out again, you know. And I was alone, you know, and I had lost so many friends, and, you know, I just felt at first, you know, when I first started drinking, I felt like that was what I always needed. I felt like it was immediately who I was. Like, this is who I am, this is who I've always been supposed to be. Like, I never, you know, felt like I had an identity until I started drinking, and then that was me, you know? And so then when that started to go away, I mean, it just didn't work anymore. It just, I felt sad and depressed and then immediately would drink to get rid of that, you know? And I didn't really have any close relationships. I'd ruined all of them, surprisingly, and you know, that's why I think... and I'm really grateful that, like, that last time I was willing to ask for help because, you know, I was done with, like, the dream of drinking that I had when I first started, you know? But, Yeah, I mean, I have an allergy to alcohol. It's never going to be okay when I drink. I always thought, I tried to transfer schools because I thought that was the problem. I thought if I was at a bigger school, then, like, I don't really know what I thought. But, you know, no matter what, when I drink, I can't stop, you know, and or I can't not have the phenomenon of craving. And when I'm not drinking, I can't think about anything else, and I definitely can't think about anything but myself. And, you know... yeah, so I came into the program April 29th, 2012. Like I said, my mom brought me to my first meeting, and I really was resistant. Thank you. I really just thought, you know, I'll do this for a little while, and then everyone will forget, and I'll go back to doing my thing, you know, my thing. But anyways, so, yeah, I mean, I heard... my sponsor, who's here, which is really cool, in a speaker tape, sorry. and he was talking about, you know, like, being so delusional. When you're drinking, you have to live in an alternate reality, or otherwise I wouldn't wake up in a hospital and then drink again. Like, I had to live in a delusional alternate reality, and I did. I was like, wow, I can't believe people think I have a problem. They are crazy, and, like... My friend tried to have an intervention with me, and I left, and she was crying because I told her so many mean things about herself. But that's what I did when I came here, too. Like, I still was living in my delusion, my reality. You know, I still, like, you know, I had, like I said, all these conspiracies that this doesn't work, but, you know, there's, like, five or multiple watches this week, you know, and, like, that's the real evidence. It's not what... I told myself, you know, it's not, no one really could be happy if they didn't drink, like, no one would be happy if they went through what I went through, you know, it's like, this works, and it's called How It Works in the book, and like, you know, it's really shocking to me that it works, but it really does, you know, it really does, and it's always the same thing, it's always the same solution, it's really simple, because in my mind, everything is so complicated, like, everything on my fourth step was like, this is this crazy drama that I can't even explain to you. And it was like, oh, okay, I was selfish. I was dishonest, you know. I did something terrible to this person, and I resent them, you know. And, yeah, and I think, like, I got into, like, my real bottom when I came in because I realized that I was sick because I wanted to die, you know. Like, I was like, oh, I'm crazy. And thank God, because finally I just did whatever my sponsor said, and I wish I could go back and do that sooner, like a few months sooner, you know, and not gone through all that pain of trying to do it my way and try to figure out a way that is exactly what I want it to look like, because I never will. And, you know, people would always come up here and say, like, my life is beyond my wildest dreams. And I was confused because I thought, like, my wildest dreams is, like, I'm famous. Like, everybody knows me. Everyone wants to be me. Like, I have all these, like, dogs. And, you know, it's not that. You know, like, it's really beyond my wildest dreams today. Today it is beyond my wildest dreams to wake up and not be so fearful and not have all these thoughts in my head and to be able to help somebody else who doesn't think this works. You know, like, sponsoring is... like, the coolest thing that's ever happened to me, and I can't believe I get to do it. And I can't believe I get to have, like, real connections, you know, and it's not a miracle. I mean, I guess it's kind of a miracle, but it's just, really, it's just what was in the book and just what my sponsor said, you know. It wasn't a lightning bolt from God coming down, and now you're happy, you know. But that is a life beyond my wildest dreams, because I never even was happy and serene or, like, had peace of mind before I even started drinking, you know, and I have that now, and that's, like, really a sufficient substitute and vastly more than that, as they say, I guess. But I really want to say that sponsorship is probably the most important, or one of the most important things. I know everyone says that, but, you know, I don't see my life normally, and I have to call somebody every day to get an objective perspective on it, because I have no idea. I think it's a life or death situation, thank you, no matter what, except alcoholism. And she's like, okay, self-centeredness, and this is what you do, you know, and I am doing that. I'm sponsoring other women now, and that's amazing, you know, but when you have extreme self-centeredness, you can't have a clear perspective on yourself, so you need somebody else to talk to. And I really want to thank my sober family because, you know, I've met so many, not only my sponsor, but so many amazing people who've helped me, you know, and today people were praying with me. And, you know, I hope I helped somebody tonight, but thank you for my sobriety.
And tonight, our main speaker is Walter.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Walter. My sobriety date is May 10th, 1991. I have a sponsor named Stephen W. He has a sponsor. My home group is the Atlantic Group downtown and the PAX men's group, which meets on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and half of you might be interested in that meeting. I'm only going to tell this story to this group. When I came in, I heard references to things that were very confusing. I heard people talk about the big book. And I'd look at the literature table and I did not see the big book. Well, that's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard people refer to the 12 and 12. And I'd look at the literature table, and I didn't see the 12 and 12. It's a book called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then at some groups, particularly peppy groups, I'd hear people refer to Clancy in whispered tones. To Clancy. Clancy did this. Clancy said that. And I came to learn that Clancy is another drunk who has over 50 years of sobriety now, who started a meeting in Los Angeles that has been the home to thousands of AAs. Thousands. So here's the story. I was at a very fancy meeting on the Upper East Side, like this. And I had 9 years and I was speaking. It was Serenity East. And I spoke, and at the break, a man came up to me and pumped my hand and said, "That was the best qualification I've ever heard in New York City." Okay. And I got my coffee and I went back to my seat. And he grabbed me again as I was leaving the coffee, and he pumped my hand again. And he said, "My name is Clancy, and I'm from California, and that was the best qualification I've ever heard in New York City." Now, I knew who he was, but I didn't know what he looked like. So then I put the two together, and my sponsor was there, and you were with him. And my sponsor is an erudite, brilliant, deep-voiced New Yorker. And I said, "Clancy says I'm the best speaker he's ever heard in New York City." Long pause. My sponsor said, "I will tell you when you are the best speaker in New York City." That was 12 years ago. I've never gotten that call from my sponsor. I said to him, "Are you going to come and hear me speak on Tuesday night?" He said, "No, I don't want what you have." So he's not here, which means the stories will probably be a little more entertaining. But he's been my sponsor since my 15th day, because I don't go shopping with my sponsor, and I don't shop for sponsors. He's my Alcoholics Anonymous sponsor, and I'll talk about him in a minute. But the only thing different about my story than all the other stories I've heard, the only slight difference, is I did not have my first drink till I was 23 years old. And I didn't have a drink till I was 23 because there was nothing about drunks that I liked. I hated men when they got drunk. I hated the way women acted when they got drunk. I did not like the way my dormitory looked on Saturday nights. There was nothing about alcohol that was appealing, and I was blessed. I was raised in a healthy, sober, happy home. I had and have loving parents and family. I grew up in an ordered, organized home. My dad got home at 6. And so I always felt safe. I was never surrounded by alcoholism. I saw no alcoholics when I was growing up. It had nothing to do with it. Nothing. When I was 23, as it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says I had reached some measure of success. And I had the job I wanted, I had the home I wanted, I had the girlfriend I wanted, I owed no money, I was happy. But I'm an alcoholic, and I was born an alcoholic. And when I was 23 and happy, a switch went off in my head. And the switch said, now you can coast. That's an amazing thought for a 23-year-old. Now I could coast. And in that package of now I could coast, I was in a bucolic setting, surrounded by people who loved me, who I loved, could not have been safer. And they ordered gin and tonics. And I ordered a gin and tonic. And halfway down the first drink of my life, I encountered alcoholic math. Because it felt incredible. I relaxed. I felt at one with the universe. I was close to you. I was clever. And halfway down the first drink of my life, I had this thought. I've heard about doubles. I bet a double would feel twice as good. Alcoholic math. Twice as much poison equals twice as much good news. Alcoholic math. So the second drink of my life was a double. And it was doubles for the rest of the month. Later that month, I was in a bar, surprisingly, and I was with a guy who knew how to drink. And he ordered da-da-da with a splash. I said, what's that? He said, they just pour the gin on the rocks, they put a little splash of tonic on top to kill the taste. I'm like, I'm there. And then it was with a splash ever since. And I had all the information I needed about the problems with alcohol from eighth grade health class. I knew that alcohol was bad. I knew that too much alcohol was worse. I don't believe any American gets through public schools without that education, but no amount of information, no amount of education stopped me from drinking. It had nothing to do with it. Facts have nothing to do with it. But in case I missed those facts, I had hangovers. My only disappointment in AA is that I never hear about hangovers. So I'm going to talk about hangovers. My hangover took me by the back of the neck, slammed me against the back of the neck, shoved me on the porcelain floor next to my toilet, and taught me that that was a good place to sleep. I'd wake up with these two pounding headaches here, nausea, and I'd cure it with Excedrin, Sudafed, Diet Coke, grilled cheese, and bacon. But here's the ISM part, incredibly short memory, alcoholism. The nanosecond that hangover wore off, I thought I could beat the next one. I thought I could beat the next one. And every good thing I hear in an AA meeting, I will forget by the time I get to the corner. Because my disease doesn't want me to remember the pain, and it doesn't want me to remember the solution. Now, here's an astonishing fact. If somebody who's not an alcoholic gets a hangover, they go, that is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. It will never happen again, and it doesn't. It never happens again. As an alcoholic, I always thought I could beat it. The end of my story is no different than anyone else's either. I've never heard anybody in AA say, I could not handle all the good news, I had to go to AA. I'm an alcoholic, I drank, things didn't go well. Here was my moment of clarity. I had been on a work assignment in Orlando, Florida, and I had met a delightful, beautiful woman named Michelle. And Michelle had ice blue eyes and Mariah Carey hair. She had a permanent tan. She was 22 years old. She drove a red car. She was really good at her job. She had money, and she went to the gym ready for fun. With my alcoholic spiel, I convinced her to come and spend a weekend with me in New York a while after this work assignment had ended. And she did. And we were at dinner, and I had borrowed $500 to pay for dinner because it was the end of my drinking. And I was in an apartment that was in foreclosure. I hadn't worked in months. Whatever pennies I had, I used to bribe the doorman to keep away the process service because that's where my alcoholism took me. I lived in a fancy co-op downtown, and I promise you I'm the only person in the 125-year history of that co-op to have had his electricity turned off. Con Ed does not want to turn off my electricity. They try hard to not make it happen, but I help them. So we're at dinner, and as I'm speaking, I am not believing one thing I'm saying. The jig was up. I didn't believe one thing I was saying. And pretty soon, she was not going to believe one thing I was saying. And she was so sweet and had such clear eyes that was my mirror. It talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that when an alcoholic looks at himself in the mirror, it is not a pretty sight. It does not make me feel good. So I did the only thing an alcoholic could do. I decided to entertain her. And the way I decided to entertain Michelle was by taking the glass of red wine, filling my mouth with it, and using it as a fountain. And I spit the glass of red wine over the table at her suede dress, and that was my moment of clarity. The next day, I called Intergroup. And a man named Guy answered the phone. And I said, you know, I need to go to a meeting. Where should I go? Go to Perry Street. Go to Perry Street. I said, well, how will I know where the meeting is? Just look for all the other drunks outside. I said, this is the worst public relations I've ever heard. This will be the first thing I fix when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. In the first step, I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, and I've come to learn that only by admitting can I get better. If I have a broken arm, it doesn't get better unless I go to the hospital and say, this arm really hurts, I think it's broken, then it gets fixed. It won't get fixed before that. I'm the idiot who thought I could do it on his own. Years before I came here, I got on my knees one night because I knew my drinking was bad. And I prayed for something. I said, God, if you give me this thing, it was a material thing, I will stop drinking, like it's a big gift to God. And because my God has a sense of humor, God gave it to me. And I stopped drinking all on my own for 3 years, without AA, without a psychiatrist, without talking to anybody. And I woke up every morning with a 10-step hangover, because I was trying to process the normal of life events through a dry drunk's brain. I did not wake up angry because I was without my bottle. I was angry because I did not have help. But I woke up every morning angry. And when I came here, I admitted that I was an alcoholic, and that way I could get my medicine, which is you. In the second step, I asked God to restore me to sanity. Now, I never had a problem with God. Good news for God. But I have had a continuing problem defining insanity. So the things I did normally, as a matter of course, in my first year, I look back, I go, what? And in my second year and fifth year and 10th year and 15th year and 20th year, I look back and I can't believe some of the behaviors I did in each of those years. And in a very short time, I will look back at behaviors I have today and go, what? What was I thinking? What was I doing? It's crazy. Because I have a disease that's delusional. My delusion is that I can drink, spend, eat, you name it, like anybody else, more than anybody else, and nothing happens. That's my delusion. And that's why I have to come here for you to look at me and say, you're crazy. Stop. Do something else. In the third step, the first experience I had with the third step was my 15th day, when I gave my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood God. At the 15th day, surprisingly, there were things about AA I didn't understand. And I decided that it was okay to have a sponsor. And the sponsorship person says, if you need a sponsor, come to me at the break. So right before I went to that sponsorship person, I promised myself that whoever I was given would be fine. And I would not enter a debate. And I would not shop. Maybe the best decision I've made in my life. Because I got exactly the right sponsor for me. He has more time in Alcoholics Anonymous than I do. He has done the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and put it into his life. And he has the life he wants. He is a happy man. He has an admirable life. I want an admirable life. And he was always very busy. Okay, you're fine, you're sober, I have to go. But I have so much more to share. I have so many more opinions about AA. Making sauce for a dinner party for 20. Goodbye. I got sober through the voices of the Grand Dames of AA in Lower Manhattan. These were amazing women who had 20 and 30 and 40 years. And one of them had 28 years when I came in, and her name was Fritzy. And Fritzy was British. And I don't know if she liked me or not, but she would occasionally say something to me. And she said, have you done your third step? Oh, yes, yes, I have. Describe your God. What? Describe your God. What? She said, how can you turn your will and your life over to something you can't describe? And then she disappeared in a puff of smoke. So from that point to this, I have spent regularly trying to define my God. And at that moment, I relaxed and I thought, what is my God? And the thought was, my God is funny. And to this day, the answer is, my God is funny. Last week, I'd done a lot of stuff one morning. I decided to give myself a treat and go to Grand Central Station to the food court and have lunch. I will confess to you, and only once, and I'll deny it after the meeting, that the thing in life that gives me the greatest pleasure is to dine alone and read the New York Post. And I'm in Grand Central Station. The Post is a buck. We're having tough times. I didn't spend the money that morning on the Post. I'm looking at the sea of tables that are packed. It's 12:30 in Grand Central Station. Sea of tables. It's packed. And I got still. And I just stared at the tables calmly. And there was a table for two that was empty with a pristine copy of the New York Post sitting on it. And I sat there and I had a delicious meal. And I told my 11-year-old daughter this story, a New Yorker, and she said, what, was there a ray of sunshine on the table when they... So God has given me three daughters, 11, 8, and 1. My 11-year-old, whose name is Dorothy, revealed something to me that is amazing and I will pass along to you, and it is the third step. When she was about 8, one of the mothers in her school came up to me and said, "I'm so glad that my daughter is friends with yours." I'm like, why? And it's a horrible child. Why? "Well, you know, Dorothy is the most popular kid." I'm like, what? Now, I, like maybe some other people here, looked at the playground as one of the greatest mysteries of my childhood. Like, how do they all know how to talk to each other and get along? How is that possible? I didn't get the manual. I didn't get the manual on how to get along with 8-year-olds. So I looked at Dorothy one day after confirming this fact, and I said to her, "Dorothy, you're very popular in school. How do you make friends?" And she looked at me with pity. And she said, "When I see somebody I want to meet, I relax, I smile, I walk up to them, I say my name, and I see what happens." Where's the manual? So that's alcoholic arrogance and grandiosity, that the issue is a manual I didn't get. It's not. It's maybe a one-sheeter. In the fourth step, I've heard this great phrase in AA about getting to right size, and as an alcoholic, I assume that meant smaller. It does not. It means right, which means that some information needs to get bigger and dealt with bigger, and some information needs to get smaller and dealt with smaller, but it's right size. So the first part of getting to right size is in the fourth step, I'm supposed to write down my resentments. And that takes them out of my brain, which is an amusement park. My brain has a sound machine, a whirly-cue, distortion mirror. You put in normal information, it comes out crazy. So I have to get information out of my brain and onto an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, which is manageable and disposable. And my resentments must be dealt with, or else I cannot help another alcoholic. Because if you need my help with something in AA or something physical or practical in your life, and you touch on one of my resentments that you can't see on my resentment minefield, I will not react appropriately to your request for help. You will be introduced to my resentment about helping, AA, money, parents, school, landlords, doctors, lawyers, whatever you need help with, you're going to hit one of my resentments. And that doesn't help you, and it does not keep me sober. And the practice in the fifth step of sharing this information starts the practice that I'm supposed to do the rest of my life. Share the resentments that come in and get rid of them. I've always thought it was interesting that the sixth and seventh step is that I pray for these defects of character to be removed is in two parts, because are you really ready, buddy? Are you really ready? The sixth step is like, are you sure? Because the seventh step works. And here's how it works for me. When I go into a situation which inevitably involves a ticketing agent, a state worker, anybody at the DMV, anybody who I believe is not entitled to tell me no, gets to tell me no, I will act out as an alcoholic, except I've said the seventh step prayer a few times. And the way it works for me is as a yellow highlighter. It says, okay, you have a nanosecond here to be a sober guy or a jerk. You choose. So what it does is it gives me the nanosecond of choice. Sober guy or jerk. Sober guy or jerk. Before I came here, before I met you, I did not have that choice. I would dive into rage. I was the guy that the ticket agent would buzz to get the Port Authority cops to come over and talk to, because I didn't get a first-class seat. So that's who I am. Now, in the eighth and ninth step, in the eighth step, again, it takes it out of the craziness of my head and makes a list. I make a list. And because I'm no authority on editing my life, I talk to my sponsor and I say, what do I do with this list? And he prioritizes it. He prioritizes it. Now, when I first read the ninth step, I immediately thought of the person to whom I had caused the most harm and how I could never make amends to this person. I will tell you this story. I was on that work assignment in Florida where I met Michelle. The end of the work assignment went like this. I walked into the building one day after lunch. For some reason, it felt empty. And the man who I worked for was based in New Jersey. And like a specter, when I went and sat at my desk, he appeared at my door. And he said, Walter, that's enough. You are to get on the next plane out of here. And I thought, well, I know he can throw me out of his business. I'm not so sure he can throw me out of the state, but I'm not going to test it. So I shook his hand and I thanked him. And I was right. The building had been emptied because that's how afraid they were of what my reaction was going to be to this information. That's where my alcoholism had taken me. AA works. You want to know how? I made amends to him. Every good thing I have in my work comes from that amends today, 20 years later. That man came to my wedding. Michelle came to my wedding. In the 11th step, when I got sober, I was terrified, absolutely terrified of what I had done. As I got sober that first week, I was sweating, I was scared. I realized how much money I owed. I realized all the harm I had caused. I realized how sick I was. I was physically sick. And I called a friend who was a born-again Christian. This is not about God. This is not a religious program. But for some reason, I felt the need to call my friend who was a born-again Christian in San Francisco and turn myself in, and he has a very deep voice. And after listening to me, he said these words. He said, just remember, baby Jesus loves you. And I'm like, I'm a New Yorker, please. And but that night, I was terrified. And I repeated that over and over again in the darkness. Baby Jesus loves me. I repeated it over and over and over again. I was lying in bed. My hands were like this. My eyes were closed. And I felt a physical presence in my hands. And I saw a silhouette of people in white, hundreds of them, holding hands in a circle. And that was you. That was you. And I did not think everything was going to be better, but I knew everything was going to be different. And it has been. I want to mention one thing. The name of this program is Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell nobody. In my first few months, I said to somebody in the group, I said, how do I tell my parents? Or how do I tell these people? And they looked at me and said, you don't have to tell anybody. And that is the best gift I've been given because it enabled me to stick to the principles. It enabled me to be a worker among workers. It enabled me to get sober at my own pace. I thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for asking me to be here.